You are now the Liminalist, listening to the podcast between talking to William Ramsey. I am right now. Let's jump into the thing that we wanted to talk about for sure, which is Crowley, and obviously the relevance of Crowley to everything that's going on today, which is what's drawn me back to him. Because as I don't know if you picked up, I mean, I was into Crowley in all the, I would say, all the wrong ways. Now, as a young man, I got really deeply into him, and part of what I'm doing in my research now, I would say, the primary thrust is to try and remove the implant, the cultural implant of Crowley, and boy, is it deep and insidious. So that's why I'm reevaluating everything I know about Crowley and finding out all kinds of new stuff in terms of within the context of what I now know about, you know, the inextricability of the occult with organized child abuse and trafficking and all the rest of it. So that was what drew me to your work, of course. So when did you first start getting interested in Crowley?
Really, very intensely, probably about 7 or 8 years ago, when I was a 9/11 researcher. So I was a guy who, you know, really, I'm embarrassed to say, I believed, you know, the lie in 2011 that bin Laden, you know, committed it. But about a year or 2 years later, you know, I started to research other people. And, you know, at a certain point, I realized that 9/11 was an inside job that was fake. But during that time, I came across a guy who I actually posted one of his interviews last week, a guy by the name of Captain Eric May, and he's passed away. I think he passed away last year of ALS, but he had noticed some numerology that was associated with a lot of these dates, some of the terrorist dates and the actual date of 9/11. He noticed all these 11s, and I noticed too, 11/77, and I really didn't know what they meant, but I started just noticing them in common culture. I'm like, what does this mean? What is the... And just through kind of reading a lot, I'm a very, very, you know, I read often. So I just came to this person, Crowley. I just kind of, wow, he really liked the number 11. This is it. So then I really, really researched Crowley, and I realized that the numbers and the dates of 9/11 or occult and thelemic numbers, Crowley's kind of central numerological ideology in large print in that day. It's 11/77/93/175.
Yeah.
So that was really it. So then I was like, well, who's Crowley? I had a very topical understanding. I remember the Ozzy Osbourne song. I heard about him, but I really didn't know who this person was. So then I read a lot of biographies. I read the Simons biography. I read Lawrence Sutton's biography, which was excellent, who I've actually been in contact with. He doesn't want to be interviewed, but a really interesting guy. He also did a Philip K. Dick biography.
Yeah.
Sutton, there was another guy who was an OTO member. His name is Kaczynski. He's been on TV a few times. So I read his. So I read everything. Simon, then I kind of put the pieces together. Who are these people? Who was Simons? I didn't know when I read Simons, The Great Beast, that he was Crowley's literary executor. So then I kind of wanted to get into the core documents of Crowley. So then I started reading and putting in order all of Crowley's written work from when he first started writing, which was the early poems, which was, some of his early poetry when he was at Cambridge, to everything at the end, which was Magic Without Tears, which was a compilation of his writings to prospective students. And then I read through them. I read some. I really wasn't interested in the magical part of Crowley. I really wanted to know who Crowley was and who his followers were. And that's really how that book came together. I never thought I'd be an author. That's how Prophet of Evil, 9/11, Aleister Crowley, 9/11, and the New World Order came together, because I believed, and I still believe, that all of those elements of the date of 9/11, Aleister Crowley's ideas, and the New World Order are all kind of overlap, the ideology. So that was it. So then I actually have been to a number of private library collections and things like that of Crowley in the United States. So I've actually kind of read stuff between him and Austin Osmond Spare, J.F.C. Fuller, people who I covered in Children of the Beast, which was my book, follow-up book to Prophet of Evil, kind of tracing Crowley's influence as much as possible. And there was a lot left out, a lot of other information about musicians and writers and stuff like that. But I think I tried to be as comprehensive as possible in Children of the Beast. So that was really how I got into Crowley and tried to understand what his ideas were.
Are you familiar with Robin Bryans' work?
No, I don't think so.
Right. It's not surprising because it's very, very obscure, but he wrote several memoirs, and one of them, it's the only one that I managed to get, it's like they've been taken out of circulation. It's called The Dust Has Never Settled. And Bryans was an insider of the political aristocracy in Britain, and he was friends with, have you heard of Lord Tredegar?
Yes, that sounds familiar.
Evan Tredegar. So I'm bringing it up because I found it to be a gold mine in terms of stuff about Crowley, because Crowley was accomplices with Tredegar, who was a British aristocrat, and Tredegar was a magician, an occultist, and he performed black masses on a regular basis. And this is what Bryans writes about. It's just there, kind of, it just pops up throughout the text. It's not about any particular subject, it's his memoirs, right, and all these people he knew, but he continues to come back to Crowley and Tredegar and how they performed these black masses together. Crowley was the high priest, and he sometimes insinuates and sometimes outright states what was going on there. I mean, he's it depends how criminal the activities are. So he talks about drinking human blood and disinterring corpses and stuff like that, as he just says it outright. But then he infers in terms of child abuse and even murder is inferred in there as well. So it's very, I can send you a PDF because there's quite a few very interesting leads in there.
But I would love to read that. I mean, Crowley did associate with the kind of upper crust. He was kind of like, that was the only people he liked to hang out with, was really people of his class. So
yeah,
that would surprise me. And there are references in his writings to child sacrifice, Lever 66, The World's Tragedy. You know, those are, you know, kind of symbolic. Well, I think Lever 66 outright says, you know, you'll sacrifice the child on the altar and the blood will cover the altar as wine or something like that. So
yeah.
The admirers of Crowley never bring it up.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, I definitely wanted to get to that, so we might as well just go straight to that question, because that's the one, I guess, I think you read, or at least were aware of my exchange with Peter Lavender around this question. And it was exemplary, I think, in terms of how the Crowley, I don't even know what to call them, right? I mean, some of them are Crowley scholars, and some of them are like Lavender, who's just more of a scholar of the occult, but he writes a lot about Crowley. He insists that he's not a Crowleyite. He insists he's not defending Crowley, and yet that's absolutely what my experience is of him doing. And then obviously there's the actual Thelemites, and obviously they're going to defend Crowley. But there's just this kind of wall of denial. I was reading specifically, what's his name, Milo Duquette, you know, that author.
Yes.
And he writes about that specific, not the passage you referred to, but the more famous one or infamous one in magic to practice, theory and practice, about sacrificing a child and Crowley's footnote and the idea it's a joke and blah, blah, blah. And he's obviously, I mean, you know the line, right? He's just saying that Crowley was a shit stirrer and he was just irresponsible and so on and so forth, without even looking into that, like how irresponsible that would be. He leaves that aside. But the basic position is, you know, at worst, Crowley was irresponsible. So, and yet, as you know, and as I know, there's just so much evidence that this is simply not the case. So, and you know, you mentioned that Kaczynski biography. I tried to read that. Actually, I even got a free copy because I was going to interview the guy, and I just couldn't. There was no way I was going to interview this guy because the book was just a disgrace. It was just a complete endorsement of Crowley and his life and his philosophy and all the rest of it, and completely shied away from any of the darker implications. And that was North Atlantic Books, right? That's a New Age publisher. So the Crowley industry is massive, and the dominant narrative about Crowley, it's very weird because it includes the world's wickedest man and the dark stuff, but only insofar as, oh, that was Crowley's own PR, you know, his own thing, and he just created this cloak of darkness, and you're, if you fall for it, you're just a naive, or you must be a Christian, and, you know, because basically, no, he was this just a very deep-thinking occult philosopher who, you know, he explored many things, but he would never do anything like that, right?
Right. Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because I think that the very advanced occultist or Thelemites or Thelemites actually bring up certain things because they already have a response to it. So they know that standard response. Oh, Crowley was joking around. He was talking about, you know, magical masturbation. That was not actually authentic, but they deliberately leave out things like Liber 66 or the World's Tragedy and the details in the World's Tragedy, which would make a Christian just recoil in horror. The kind of statements in the World's Tragedy where Crowley talks about John being Christ's lover and that Mary was raped by Romans, which was actually an old kind of Jewish myth. Pantera was supposedly the father of Christ. And Crowley references in there, but they never want to talk about that. Actually, in some of the readings of J.F.C. Fuller put together a lot of Crowley's work, and in that he made a category, like a category of all his books, and the one under the World's Tragedy was never let anybody read this. So it's a remarkable work if you really want to take the time to pour through it and kind of get what Crowley says. In the intro, Crowley talks about sodomizing all the young men of England and how much his mom talked about Christ. That drove him crazy. So I think that they're deliberately ignoring stuff, and that's what I found. That's kind of, once I got through the biographies and started reading really what he said, even in his own confessions where he talks about sacrificing a cat and laughing about this whole family who died mountaineering on a climb that he did, and they all came down in a body bag and just kind of, you know, blithely, you know, didn't care that much about their death. You know, you see that this guy was very callous in his personal, something that they never really bring up. They always call him, you know, a man who loved laughter and loved love, because he used the word love all the time. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, have you formulated any kind of theory on how exactly this has been achieved? Like, how it is that somebody who is so patently obviously, or was so patently obviously, well, to use the common phrase, a psychopath, you know, just a really destructive individual. Okay, brilliant. I mean, if he wrote those texts, he was a very accomplished writer, and yeah, he knew, he had a deep sort of knowledge base that he was drawing from. But it still seems improbable to me that. I mean, one of the ways I try and reframe it in my own writing about him is, you know, if somebody like Ted Bundy had written fantastic works or painted fantastic pictures, we wouldn't be footnoting the crimes, right? We would be footnoting the artwork and saying, well, here's a serial killer who happened to have this artistic talent. Isn't that strange and interesting and disturbing? We wouldn't be reversing it and saying, what a wonderful artist he was, but he killed a few people and raped a few women, and, you know, but that's just, it's not really relevant if it comes to appreciating the art. So how is it, do you think, that it got flipped around with Crowley and all of these things that he was into that were just so damning, really, have been de-emphasized to the extent that basically his reputation is not just intact, but it's probably more, you know, elevated than ever.
Right. Well, I think that you make a good point, because I think that the people who tout Crowley have expurgated the darker elements of it, and they rely upon other people's you know, not unwillingness to kind of go through and look through the actual real truth about Crowley. So that's why I think that he has is in such high repute with a lot of these kind of modern occultists, is they really don't know the darker elements. They probably read things by Kaczynski or, talk about things about his follower and all this other stuff that's very important is left out. One of the more important things that I came across was the writings of Betty May, who went to Crowley's magical, you know, studio or whatever in Cefalù.
Yeah, and the Abbey of Thelema, yeah.
Abbey of Thelema. So, and she was the girlfriend of a guy who died there, a guy by the name of Raoul Loveday, who was already sick before he died there. He had actually fallen off a roof and fell on a metal fence that pierced his abdomen. So he already kind of had a lingering condition before he died there. But these biographies leave her out because she said things that were negative about Crowley, things that she was afraid of him. She called him the Mystic, capital M-Y-S-T-I-C. So she didn't really use his name, but it was clearly Crowley. And so I do think that that's why he's had – people have this kind of idealized conception of Crowley without kind of the darker stuff. And I also think that his superficial – people's superficial enjoyment of what he said, like do what you will and magnify yourself, I think is very, you know, you can do all the sex you want and drugs you want, is to the artistic and cultural class. I think that that is something that to them, you know, is a very positive statement.
So speaking of these darker aspects, because they've been de-emphasized, but the fact they've been de-emphasized in itself is a little bit mysterious, don't you think? I mean, like, because they're so, like, how is it that, okay, so here's a specific example. There's the Colin Wilson bio of Crowley and the Nature of the Beast. I read it when I was 25 or something. I thought it was crap. I was into Crowley at that time, so I thought it was just kind of an ignorant dismissal of Crowley and whatnot. But there's a thing in there I discovered just now, and I don't know what I thought of it back then. I must have just glazed over it, about Crowley tying a Negro boy to a tree, cutting a hole in his stomach, and inserting his penis into the hole.
Wow. Yeah, I don't remember that.
Right. So apparently it came from Oliver Wilkinson, who was the son of Lewis Wilkinson, who was Crowley's executor, right? As in, you know, the guy who took care of his estate. So it came from a reputable source. Now, Colin Wilson, he's a bit of a pulp author, but he's also a very respected author. So the question isn't did Crowley do that or didn't he? I mean, who the hell knows? My question is, how is it possible that something like that can be in the mainstream, in a well-read biography of Crowley, and not get picked up by every other Crowley biographer and scholar thereafter to either disprove it or prove it?
It's a great question. Like I said, I think that the people who have an interest in Crowley's, you know, magic and magical system are the one who are establishing his repute or his reputation. Because I don't think, you know, I'm definitely a Crowley critic, but they're looking through all of the corpus of all of Crowley's work and anybody who's criticized him, there really wasn't anybody after maybe John Bull who wrote The Wickedest Man in the World or The Man We'd Like to Hang. I can't think of anybody. Maybe a few Christians, like I can't remember the guy's name, but there really wasn't anybody who really went through and looked into Crowley in detail that I came across. So, you know, maybe the most critical was Simons or Colin Wilson. You know, the Crowleyites really didn't like Simons' treatment of Aleister Crowley. They thought it was too critical, and they expected Simons to kind of carry on Crowley's magical tradition, which, you know, it doesn't seem he was more interested in Crowley as kind of an important figure as opposed to, you know, master of the temple who's going to teach Simon. So unlike Kenneth Grant, who was sat at Hastings with Crowley and learned under him. But so that's why I don't think that there's a lot of people who really went through. I mean, Crowley, it's very hard to get into the details of Crowley because it's such a vast corpus of writing. I don't think admirers of Crowley have compiled all of his writing into one spot because he wrote under different names and wrote so much for things like Vanity Fair and some of these kind of magazines in New York when he was in New York posing as a German sympathizer. But Yeah, so I don't think, and to be honest with you, I'd like to go back and read through it again because I didn't really get into the magical aspects of really what he promised. You know, I'd seen some of his rituals, cross of a frog, where you emulate Christ and nail a frog to a cross, and then mock it. You know, mocking Christianity, you bury it for 3 days.
Hmm.
That's one of the more lurid, Crowley rituals nobody talks about, but there's a lot there. So. It does take work, you know. His confessions was 500 pages, so most people, well, not most people, but a lot of people would just look at that and say, no way, it's too much.
It was more, so, actually. It was about 900 pages.
900? Wow, yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's why there's, you know, people who really want to get into Crowley are people who are, you know, excited by the promise of Crowley, generally, I think.
One.
Have you read some of the so-called Crowley scholars like Marco Passi, I think it is, and Hugh Urban? Have you read these guys?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, because I was in contact with them briefly because they didn't really follow it through, even though I tried to. And if, for example, Hugh Urban, he's written about, I mean, I have a quote that I use in the work I'm finishing now, which is about how Crowley's was attempting to access a power beyond anything that the OTO had accessed via transgression, and basically the correlation was between the acts of transgression and accessing this forbidden power, and so obviously that was very intriguing, and I emailed Hugh Urban to ask, you know, how far I thought Crowley might have gone, you know, with that, on that quest of power through transgression, which I think is very key to understanding Crowley and Thelema and occultism in general, right? In fact, I think that's even a synopsis, really, of occultism is. And he acknowledged, probably pretty far, but then he offered some very mild examples, like eating his own excrement and whatnot. So I just asked him point blank, what do you think that he might have been raping children and things of that nature? And he acknowledged that it was intriguing, was the word he used, but then he said, actually, I'm not really that focused on Crowley now, and maybe you should talk to somebody else. So I did get the feeling that I'd been palmed off a bit, and that did make me wonder, you know, how. Because it's pretty easy to see how, as you're saying, occultists and Thelemites who are invested in the will to power mythos of Thelema and all the rest of it, they're going to want to de-emphasize the dark sides, even or especially if they're doing them. And then as far as it being an industry, same. You know, you want to make a lot of money, North Atlantic Books, they're not going to be able to sell a Crowley bio to New Ages if it's got all of that hideous stuff in there. So that's all pretty clear. But in terms of the academia, such as it is, covering this stuff up, that's a bit more mysterious. I mean, that to me suggests actual complicity of some kind. Well,
I think that, yeah, I mean, I think that there might be involvement. One of the oddities I found while researching Crowley is that in Europe, there are actually professors who are professors of kind of Western esotericism or something like that. I think Marco Passio is one of them. Or is it Passo? I can't remember his last name.
Yeah.
But there are a bunch of people writing about Crowley in Europe and actually compilations. I think Passo came out with a book recently. But yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, if you look at Tobias Churton, who came out with a couple books on Crowley, The Beast in Berlin, which, and Aleister Crowley, the biography which I read, which was just a fawning, overweening, praiseful thing of Crowley. And I've seen some of Tobias Churton's lectures, and they're just incredible. How little the kind of darker aspects of Crowley are brought up, or anything really about, you know, this, the kind of selfish narcissism that Crowley thought was, you know, fine, and very little about kind of the darker, you know, the, you know, when Crowley was at the Abbey of Thelema, he encouraged the kids to be involved in their, you know, sexual activities, and you know, nobody really wants to talk about that, but that's what he said, you know, and that's what he wrote. He encouraged that, and it's interesting. One of the so Crowley, on the way to the Abbey of Thelema, picked up this woman as a consort slash nanny. Her name was Nanette Shumway, and they had a daughter. Crowley had a daughter, and the daughter of Crowley moved to Berkeley, California, and lived there, and passed away in 2014. And it was unfortunate that I wasn't able to make contact with her. But it's remarkable that a living member of the Abbey of Thelema, you know, made it to California. She was up by Berkeley, but. Yeah, so I think that's one of the things that was a very, you know, theme in all the people that I've read, is like, God, you guys are leaving out so much information.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, I mean, bringing back to this Hugh Urban's point, that if you're going to understand Crowley, you've got to look at his philosophy of transgression, do what thou wilt, and combined with the word of sin is restriction.
Right.
And his own admissions or his own descriptions of how he set out to commit all of the acts that were most appalling to him and that went in defiance of all Christian morality.
And he, you know, that I think that there's somewhere in one of those writings, like the demonic writings or something, that he wrote about that was how he got power, was through transgression. So, yeah, I mean, it's. Yeah, I think that a really honest, objective view of Crowley has to include some of these darker rituals and, you know, the way he treated other people and what he encouraged other people to do, which was, you know, this kind of the selfishness. And you know, so I think that, yeah, I think it's unfortunate that conception of Crowley is out there. I always remember, I see this guy, Sarian, do you know who, I think it's Michael Sarian, have you heard of him?
It rings a bell.
Sarion.
Oh, Michael Sarin, yeah.
So he says, Crowley's this wonderful man. You know, it's one of these things I came across from researching Crowley. He's a beautiful, wonderful man, kind of like Tobias Churton.
Wow.
And, yeah, I mean, that video's out there. You can look up Sarin.
Yeah, he did it with Red Ice. Red Ice were part of that film that Sarin made.
Oh, interesting. So, yeah, so... He's doing something else called, what are they doing it on? He's on some new program, but he's actually butted heads with Juan Milo Duquette. He calls Milo Duquette bad names. Who incident? I include that guy in Children of the Beast, but you know, he got his entry into the OTO by McMurtry, who was sat at Crowley's knee, you know, so.
Right.
Well,
sorry, what was that last bit?
I was just saying, you see this lineage of Crowley, you know, people who've been inducted through people who knew Crowley, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that's what we're looking at, is my sense. And, I mean, maybe taking a leap here, but my sense is that Crowley himself was part of an aristocratic lineage, and I don't necessarily mean a bloodline, but probably that too, but in terms of an occult, you know, power structure, and that continues to this day. And so most of the PR around Crowley is tightly controlled by that network, would be my guess there.
I would agree with that. I bet that there are many people unknown who are maintaining this perception of Crowley, you know, who, you know, was an elitist and really want, I mean, at the end of his life, when he's reading, you can tell that he's trying to make sure that his legacy is maintained by contacting people, writing people. And, you know, I think that there's, people would be surprised about how many people are into the OTO or were in the OTO. Mm. I mean, I've heard rumors that James Franco's in the OTO. So
That wouldn't surprise me. I actually saw, I think, well, maybe it was via you. It probably was the Daily Mail article about how the OTO was the new Scientology.
Yeah.
Celebrity religion.
Peaches Geldof was probably in the OTO. Yeah, so there's a lot of guys. I wouldn't be surprised LaVenda's in the OTO. This Damian Echols, who was part of the West Memphis 3, who a bunch of celebrities got out of the jails, was in the OTO, confirmed in the 90s, and gave all his library to the OTO. His Black Magic library, who got arrested for murdering 3 8-year-olds.
Right, and then there's Colin Battley cult.
Colin Battley, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, that has been framed by the media as some, you know, crazed sort of white trash independent cult. But I'm speaking to somebody right now who knew Battley and knew the fact that he was part of the IoT, at least, which is Pete Carroll's chaos magician thing, and he's pretty damn sure that Battley was in the OTO as well. And why, you know, why wouldn't he have been? The guy was on the occult circuit, apparently, in the UK. All his members were tattooed with the Eye of Horus, and Crowley was, you know, Book of the Law was his Bible. So,
and I include that in my book. He used to give lectures out of it. I mean, he was something else. I didn't know how connected he was when I read, but the IoT, supposedly Burroughs and Leary were members of the IoT as well.
Supposedly, yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, that could be just hype on the IoT's part, but
That's what it. I mean, I've read that online.
Right, Wikipedia, yeah.
Exactly. So you read the same thing I did. So.
Yeah. Did you come across Alexander's claim that he was?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that he was, yeah. So it's interesting that these two kind of founders of witchcraft, Gardner and Alexander, said they have some connection to Crowley. But he said, what did Alexander, Sanders said that he studied under Crowley. Didn't they say they had sex or something like that?
Yeah, he said, what he said, and it's very hard. I mean, it's just in the Wayback Machine online now. It's the closest I could get to any actual record of it. But in an interview in 78, Sanders said that he described how when he was 10, his grandmother took him to meet this man that turned out to be Crowley, or he later realized was Crowley. But anyway, how the man sexually initiated him at 10, right? And so it was just sort of hanging there, and although it seemed credible to me, but it was just this isolate, you know, website that wasn't even on the internet anymore. But then I recently found Sanders in a book of interviews, interviewed by Farron, I think his name is. He's quite a well-known occult figure also, and he describes meeting Mr. Alexander, who was Crowley, and Crowley giving him a lifeless Levi ring at the age of 10. So all the circumstances and the anecdotes the same, basically, except that it doesn't include the sex part.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, Crowley thought himself the resurrection of Eliphas Levi.
Yeah.
Levi died in 1875, and Crowley was born like something like 9 months later or something like that.
Right.
It's interesting that Sanders ended up, I think, in Bexhill in southern England, right where Crowley ended up. For some reason, they kind of ended up close to each other, which I found also interesting.
Hmm.
But Sanders has done, there's a video of Sanders out there where he conducts a kind of magical ritual, and it's remarkable because it's just full visual inside of a circle. They drown some idol, so it's some kind of symbolic water drowning. There's all kinds of magical ropes that supposedly hold on to energy, and he lays down on top of a woman. It's really amazing because there were so many similarities with that and what happened to the three kids in the West Memphis 3 deaths. It was, you know, something very like they were acting out something in West Memphis 3, something out of a Alexander's ritual, something else.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah, I mean, that book, yeah, it's real. I mean, that guy was talked about cruelly on the stand in 1993 and, you know, still chumming up with, like, hardcore occultist people. I mean, there's a picture of Damien Eccles with Genesis P. Orridge, who I covered in Children of the Beast, and Marilyn Manson. These guys are all really admire Damien Eccles for some reason.
Yeah, Genesis Porridge, he just pops up everywhere.
Yeah, he does. I mean, he goes back to Psychic Youth, Psychic TV, yeah. This band Coil with Peter Christopherson, some other guy, I can't remember his name. This was an offshoot of Genesis P. Orridge. They left, supposedly, saying that Orridge was trying to run a cult. And, yeah, Orridge himself said he had a meeting with Crowley when he was younger, you know?
He had a vision, yeah. It was after Crowley had died, yeah.
So, and then these guys are all pictured with Burroughs. So Burroughs is a consistent theme. Leary's with Burroughs, Genesis P. Orridge, all these guys, you know, they all go and make some pilgrimage to go talk to Porges, like, in so, the Bonnet. Yeah, Kurt Cobain, these guys.
Right. So, I mean, this is the culture that I mean, we all grew up in it, but I mean, I grew up really, really in it. Like, my brother even knew Genesis Porridge, and he had Throbbing Gristles posters on his wall and stuff, and then Burroughs, and all, you know, it was the value set that I was born into. I don't know if you've looked at any of my background, but
What kind of years were that?
I was born in 67, so when I was about 10 was when my brother was, because he was 4 years older, so he was hanging out with Genesis Porridge when he was a teenager, I guess. And
what country were you?
In Britain.
Britain, okay.
In Yorkshire.
Yorkshire.
And so, I mean, there's all kind of, I don't know if you'd call them clues or whatever you want to call them, but like when I first heard David Bowie's Hunky Dory, it was in my brother's room and I became a Bowie fan. And then, of course, later I realized that Bowie sings about Crowley on that album. So I would have first heard about Crowley through David Bowie, who I became a fan of. There's all kinds of indications like this, the way in which, like, Thelema or whatever you want to call it, This ideology of power abuse was inserted into my psyche, you know, infiltrated me, and really, I mean, deeply took me over. So by the time it was actually through Castaneda, I discovered Castaneda through an astrologer, but when I read Castaneda, I was so blown away that I went straight to Crowley because I thought, well, if Castaneda's right, then I want to hear what Crowley has to say, because, you know, he's the guy to go to, right, if you want to learn about sorcery. So it was like it was all set up in advance for me, and I just drank the Kool-Aid right down. And
when you first encountered Crowley, how did you, what were the first things you read, or what did you do?
I just have to start recording again. My recording system crashed. I bought The Confessions and Moonchild, which is funny because I would have bought those two because they were the ones in the bookshop, right? But Moonchild is one that is always coming up,
yes,
as a blueprint, right? I read it, I didn't understand it, and I didn't get through The Confessions. So I really, it was kind of just like I got the books because I wanted to. It was almost like paying tithes, you know, tithing to the king or something. Like I realized I wanted to connect to Crowley. I mean, this is kind of how I look at it now, that I'm trying to get clear of this infection, is how I see it. Was that it was like I got introduced to Crowley, and even though I didn't read very much, it went in at quite a deep level. And then I met this guy in San Francisco who was this LSD guru, and he was really into Crowley, and we did LSD together, and he woke me up once reading Crowley to me in my ear, kind of thing. He was really into the Crowley indoctrination thing, and then a bit after that I got Book of the Law at a very key time in my life, and I read it, and it just completely I just took it on completely. Like, I took on Horus as the archetype that I identified with. And, you know, this was all completely despite the fact that I didn't trust Crowley. I considered him dodgy, you know, as a person, and I was aware that it was very weird, you know. It wasn't like I was naive by normal standards. Like, this is what I think is interesting about Crowley, because it's much more subtle and much more insidious than what we tend to expect guru brainwashing methods to be like. Because Crowley telegraphed his negative side. He put it front and center, right?
Yeah, interesting. Did you come from a Christian background?
No, I mean, that's actually why I brought it up, because I was going to ask you, because when we talk about all these characters, especially Burroughs, or these are people that were kind of my heroes for years, so it's a real long process to extricate myself from this, because it's like just about every kind of cultural value that I've adopted is can be sourced back to this snake's pit, you know? Whereas for you, I guess,
did you find like a different kind of ideology to move toward away from Burroughs and Crowley?
I don't want to replace one ideology with the other, you know, because I think they're all pretty pernicious. But on the other hand, it's like we can't move forward without some sort of map. So the closest I have to an ideology now is psychology, which I really hope is more than an ideology, right? Because I don't trust Freud, obviously, and so on and so, or Jung for that matter. But I've just found that the tools of psychology have really been effective.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Interesting. I mean, you're kind of an interesting case study then, somebody who actually went right into this under the Crowley and Burroughs and Genesis P. Orge is pretty heavy-duty UK underground. I mean, his whole philosophy kicked out of England and, you know, sent to Leary's archivist. Actually, he lived with Winona Ryder. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
So now, when he got kicked, when they got kicked out, Orridge, he went to Northern California, north of San Francisco, and lived with Timothy Leary's archivist, who ended up archiving a guy by the name of Horowitz, which is Winona Ryder's real name.
And I think he must be related to Mitch Horowitz, no?
I don't think so.
No?
That would be interesting, because Mitch Horowitz wrote The Occult History of America, right?
Yeah, and he's works for Penguin Torture, which published Whitley Strieber now. So it just seemed like there must be a lineage there, right? Maybe I'm jumping the gun. But
no, that would be interesting. I mean, Horowitz is not an uncommon, you know, surname here.
Right, true.
So that's...
So, but for yourself, you were raised a Christian.
I was raised in the Catholic Church. So I actually was brought up, I was confirmed in the Catholic Church until probably I was about 16 or 17. I was never a really ardent Catholic, and I had problems with it from a kind of early age. I consider myself a Christian now. I go to a Presbyterian church. I don't like the national leadership of the Presbyterian church, but I definitely am a Bible-believing Christian, and I'm not a bitter ex-Catholic. I just didn't – there was a lot of stuff about the Catholics I didn't. I didn't like the priests and the kind of sterile church meetings I thought – you did basically, if you were a Catholic, you kind of go and do the same thing every time. Stand up, sit down, pray, kneel. And there's a lot of idols and stuff like that, graven images in the Catholic Church that I didn't care for. But I actually, when I was in Europe, when I was like 17 or 18, I went and I got into a papal meeting. And so I was close to the Pope John Paul II. There's probably a picture of me somewhere out there just living it up. Have you ever seen the picture of the Pope where he's sitting in this big auditorium or audience, and in the background it looks like there's this wood with like Christ up above? It's kind of a creepy auditorium. There's pictures of it. Have you ever seen that picture?
No.
It's not in St. Peter's. It's in like the cat. I was in that room, 20 years ago. I'm 48 now. 30 years ago. I can tell stories that people wouldn't even believe, but associate with Catholics because, yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't even want to talk about it. But, yeah, so, yeah. I mean, I'm not – both of my parents are still alive, and they're both Catholic, so I don't really like to talk about it too much.
Sure. Well, what I was – I mean, the context I was bringing it up in was in terms of – it seems like you would have been somewhat prophylactically protected, let's say, from this kind of deviant art culture, whatever we're going to call it now. I mean, I'm more and more aligned with Christian sensibility, even though I'll never become a Christian myself, but just in terms of agreeing just how pernicious and how corrupting the modern culture is.
I mean, I think that's true, and I think too, I mean, I definitely got into like heavy metal and that kind of stuff.
Oh, you did? Because this is a rebellion phase, right?
I was a kid, you know, youthful type stuff. You know, I went to metal concerts. I saw one of Metallica, Day on the Green. They used to have these concerts in Northern California. Go there. I actually broke my toe at a Rage Against the Machine concert. that was an interesting concert. But, yeah, so, you know, I mean, I wasn't... I didn't have, like, Crowley had this rebellion against this kind of strict, sterile upbringing, and that's why I think he had this idea of no restrictions. And when Crowley talked about freedom, that's why I think that was that grip that had a hold on me, to get away from what he was. So yeah. I didn't have that kind of experience.
Yeah, well, I think with Crowley, and I haven't gone into this in my book because it's too much of a can of worms, but I think a hell of a lot of it comes down to his mother. Which, of course, is always the case with everyone. But with Crowley, it really, it's kind of written large because of her calling him the beast and him hating her so much. And then I think at some point he even explicitly stated that he wanted just to do everything that would appall her.
Yeah, he hated her and her brother. So that was part of the other thing. Like he wrote as he thinks about them and Confessions, which I include in Prophet of Evil. So yeah, I mean, I think that was something he held on to his whole life. Was, I'm getting away from this. You know?
Yeah, I think so too.
And really, I mean, the English schools back then were brutal. I mean they. I don't know how they are now, but back then it was like it seemed like Crowley was getting bullied and starved and harassed. I mean, he almost died from some like I think it was a kidney disease or something like that. He had to go home. So that was probably another influence.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is obviously my tendency with psychology, but also I would just say with knowing what I know really about reality and how formative early experiences are, and particularly if they're traumatic, how they can be what drive us throughout our lives if we don't ever address that. And awareness of that means that, you know, I'm going to want to look for that in Crowley's past. And it was one of the things that struck me in not just Kaczynski's biography, more than one, but it was in his at least, was, oh, despite this or that, Crowley had a happy childhood. And I'm like, for God's sake, you know, a guy who tortures a cat to death at 14 did not have a happy childhood. I mean, just do a little digging, for God's sake, you know. But it's really like, it's again, I mean, part of another aspect of what's being de-emphasized and skirted over seems to be this. Like, he had these, okay, so his childhood is almost very little known about, really. He hated his uncle, described him as like the worst human being, so that indicates to me that his something happened there with his uncle. And then obviously his mother, and then his experiences at school, where Crowley, you can't really trust Crowley as a witness, because he's already by that point trying to glamorize the darker stuff in his life. So he talks about sodomy and this, that, and the other. But it seems to me, I mean, how much did you speculate or investigate that, the possibility that Crowley was himself raped and abused?
You know, I didn't come across any evidence of that, so I didn't see that that happening. But it might have, you know. I mean, those boys' schools and things like that, God only knows what would happen. I know that from an earlier age, he was a purveyor of prostitutes, you know. So he wrote in his book, "I brought in prostitutes like the milkman brought in milk," you know. So it seems like he had that kind of license from a very early age. Why, how, and how he got that, I don't know. But it would be interesting to find some of those records from those schools. You know, the English call them public schools, but we call them private schools. But if those records are still around, that would be really fascinating. I'd also like to find his records at Cambridge too. That would be great.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anybody has those.
All right.
And I mean, there's tons of records. There's tons of the repository of Crowley stuff. I don't know. You know, it's spread around. It's spread. There's some in Syracuse. There's some in Texas, California, and the biggest one is the. I think it's the English Museum. It's not the British Museum. It's another museum in London, where one of Crowley's followers deposited most of, you know, collected and then deposited his stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, another thing about Crowley that seems to me key to the myth of Crowley and you know, the myth that conceals the reality is this idea that he was a rebel, that he was an outsider, and that he was pushing against the status quo. But if you juxtapose that idea, which is really based on his own writings and his own self-descriptions, and I guess his actions too, because they were pretty outrageous actions. But if you juxtapose all of that with who he knew and who he hung out with,
right,
and how much influence he had and how much power he had and how much authority he had, like, I mean, working for the British intelligence, just to name one, right? Having Tom Dryburgh, who's a leading MP, basically as his disciple. Things like this, they completely negate this notion that he was an outlier and a rebel.
I agree. I mean, I think that may be promoted from, you know, at a topical level, but I think if you look at his life, he really was maybe a rebel within his class, you know, but he was still an elite class conscious person. So maybe he was, you know, getting these higher level, more educated people to follow his way. That might be his rebellion. But I wouldn't say that he was the type of, you know, Marxist rabble rouser of, you know, the proletariat or anything. No way.
Right.
You know, he was an elitist all the way through. And his relationship with his followers was always he was the boss. You know, he always was at the apex of any of those relationships. And if people couldn't take it, they just left. So that's why he had so many followers pretty much just bug out, whether it was JFC Fuller, Rigardi, York, all these other people.
So what if he was a rebel just in the way that he was doing openly what his peers in the aristocracy were doing secretly?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that would be a fair assessment. I think that he came out of the Golden Dawn and, you know, Masonry and these kind of high-level things where he was in contact with high level Masons in England at that time. So, you know, those guys are probably doing some kind of strange rituals in the lodges or something like that. So, you know, I think that Crowley's taste to acquire adherents, you know, was, he was aggressive about it. He always wanted new people to kind of join up or get into the ATA, what is it, the AA or the OTO. So if, you know, I don't know if that was really that much different. In some ways, I think that the, you know, the Masons are always trying to get adherents as well, but I don't know where they recruit from. But I mean, Crowley, you know, his recruits were always people from Cambridge or Oxford. That's why he got banned from there, because that's the place he went to obtain people to follow him. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. The whole rebellion thing, as far as his effect upon mass of society, I think was reserved only for the upper crust.
Well, yeah, it's almost like, it's sort of paradoxical. It's kind of archetypal too, like the whole thing of God, you know, in Job sending Satan to do nasty stuff for him. Well, this Satan's not really a rebel; he's just obeying God's orders. Just use that as an archetypal thing without getting into the theosophy of it. That's my sense of Crowley, is that his rebellion was actually his assignation, because the result, if we judge by the results, he brought those values to a whole generations of people who right. would then aspire to these kind of things.
Yes. You know, Crowley, he basically seeded and created through his writings a bunch of little mini Crowleys in a lot of ways. A lot of people who emulated him and carried on and created, you know, magical fraternities, kind of like Crowley did at the Abbey of Thelemis. These other people collect other people. Just like that, to teach what Crowley passed on. So yeah, I mean, I think that makes perfect sense. I think that's the way the history played out.
Yeah, and it's disastrous, you know, for me personally, because it was disastrous. I mean, it resulted in some very destructive behaviors, let's say, on my part. So I know, you know, I use myself as a case study. You know, when I attempted to embody, partly consciously, partly unconsciously, Crowley's teachings, it was disastrous, right? And that won't surprise you at all. And
that was, so many of his followers ended in disaster, suicide, penury, prostitution, jail. So, I mean, that, unfortunately, that seems to be the end up of Crowley, just like Crowley, who ended up in a boarding house on heroin.
There ends part one of my conversation with William Ramsey. His website is occultinvestigations.com. I did a couple of interviews that recently came out. One was with Robert Stark at Stark Radio, and the other was with Jan Irvin, the Irvinator, as I affectionately refer to him, at Unspun, also with Joe Atwell. You can find links to that in the comments of my blog or the news section of my website. I'll also be talking with Jan and Joe most likely next week, next Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific time. It's a live show, which is then later available online. It's also a video feed. I'm going to thank a few donators. Are there any? I'm not sure. Let me check. Just Penny, thank you for that donation this week. I guess there's been no donations for Mario. I have started the blog series to recount the events leading up to Mario's fall, his paralysis. I'm not 100% sure I will continue, because there is some objections from his family, and I want to be as considerate as possible in terms of and as clear and as conscious as possible in terms of what my motivations are and what my intents are here, which is first and foremost to help Mario. So let me know if you have any strong feelings about that. Turning 50 this coming week. Next week's podcast with David Livingston, which hopefully I'll be able to get up, set up so that I can take my holiday time. And after that with the ritual abuse survivor, Wendy Hoffman. This is Jason Horsley, once again for The Liminalist. Do support this endeavor any way that you can. If you want to donate, you just go into the sidebar at the website, audiculture.com/liminalist, and you shall be received.